Hi, everyone. I'm Gwyneth. I'm an alcoholic. All who care to, please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
All right. Shall I put this back in?
Yeah.
I'll slide it. Yeah, there we go. There we go. So when I was telling my daughter that I had the opportunity to pick up our speaker for tonight, she had a couple of questions. She said, "So you don't know this person?" I said, "No, I've never met her." And the drive is how long? It's about 2.5 hours. And she got this look on her face like, "You're going to spend 2.5 hours with a stranger?" She said, "What if you just sit in awkward silence for the whole time?" And I assured her that in AA we speak the language of the heart and that it would be just fine. And sure enough, we had a wonderful conversation. I got so much out of our chat, and I know that you'll get a lot out of her talk tonight. So with that, I introduce our speaker for tonight, Valerie from Richmond, Virginia.
Hello, family. Good to be here on a Saturday night. My name is Valerie, and I am an alcoholic. Thrilled to be here with you guys this weekend, and it is so amazing to be out with everyone. Don't touch anything, remember? Look, if I take my heels off, because I don't wear heels anymore, I mean, who does post-pandemic? If I shrink like 3 inches, you're going to have to come touch it again. Naughty words. Anyway, it's because of that comedian. Now my mind is, it's gone somewhere else. But anyway, very honored to be here. And it's wonderful to be out with family, to be with alcoholics on this road to recovery. We were also, you know, locked up for so long, even if you're an active Zoom participant. I mean, I don't know about you, but I got like a little weird, you know what I mean? So it's good to be, for me, to be back with people and being able to, like, you know, touch them real time. So it's been nice. So I'm really honored to be here. Thank you, committee, for asking me. Thank you to the area. And Gwendolyn was wonderful. She sent me a little text. She goes, "I'm the girl in the blue shirt with big curls." And I said, "I'm the tall one, a devil in a blue dress," because I was wearing a blue dress. And we walked right by each other, although she was sitting, because, you know, we know each other, we really do, and our eyes met, but we're a little shy at first, and then I walked down, and then she came around, and I'm like, "Gwen, Val, let's go," and that was it. So, and we had a lovely drive here, and it's just beautiful here, and I so enjoyed all of the speakers. Have just been amazing, and I'm going to stop gushing here and get to the real meat of the matter here in a second, but I've just had a wonderful time, and everybody's just been super kind. Okay, let's get down to it. So my home group is the Jaywalkers group in Richmond, Virginia. We meet on Tuesday nights, and we meet on Friday nights, so if you're ever down in Richmond, Virginia, we would love to have you. We have a closed big book discussion on Tuesday nights, and Friday night is our big open speaker meeting, and everyone is welcome to come. Sometimes the minister at the church where we hold the meeting will come and sit and listen to our speaker. So it really is open to everyone, whoever in the community wants to learn more about alcoholism and what recovery looks like. So you're welcome to come. My sobriety date is October 13th, 1992. That, however, is not my first sobriety date. My first sobriety date was 10 years prior in 1982 when I was 15 years old and walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous down in Florida. So just to tell you a little bit about how I got there, I'm 55, by the way. If you're trying to do the math, I'll just save you from it right now. But because that's what I would be doing, because I'm, That's how I am. But anyway, I was really taken back when I was listening to the Al-Anon speaker, because I grew up in an alcoholic household as well. My biological father was an alcoholic. My stepdad was an alcoholic. I mean, I really come from a long line of neurotics and alcoholics on both sides of the family. My mom, her pickers broke. I mean, she picked two drunks. And they both ended up being sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. So I think if this is a genetic family disease, I don't know. All I know is that I had the disease of alcohol, the ism piece, long before I picked up a drink. And I grew up in that chaotic household with a crazy drunk father who was, you know, I just remember fighting. It was violent, lots of fighting, lots of me protecting my brother, my dad bringing home women that were not my mother, lots of running around the house with pots and pans. It was just, you know, the alcoholic chaos and insanity. And I'm sure all of that stuff put a nice little twist on my personality. However, I don't know that that is why I'm an alcoholic. When I look back, you know, because one of my brothers, he grew up in the same house, and he's normal. I mean, normal as you can be normal, but he's normal. He doesn't have what I have. It doesn't do for him what it does for me. And he didn't, you know, he wasn't a suicidal 10-year-old, but I was. I was that kind of totally turned inward, fearful, out of place kid. I was just weird, just a weird kid. I was literally like that kid who was always on the outside looking in and too terrified to talk to other people. I just couldn't do it. I mean, my eyes rarely, that's why it's like, I can't believe I'm up here. My eyes never left the floor. And I just was just very closed up, felt very different, a lot of fear, a lot of just feeling different and not comfortable in my own skin, and just pretty much miserable. And when my mom and dad got a divorce, and my mom married a pilot in the Navy, and we started moving around a lot with that, I had a social drinking period. This is my social drinking period right here. It's when I would take sips off my parents' rum and cokes. That was my social drinking period right there for you. Once I had my first real drunk, I mean, it's like you hear so many people describe, it was like a spiritual awakening for me. I mean, it really was. I was like happy and at peace and comfortable. And it was like magic, and I could talk to people, and I had plans. I mean, I ended up, you know, throwing up everywhere and engaging in immoral activity and breaking a whole bunch of laws, but I couldn't wait to do it again. I could not wait, because the transformation was so profound for me, what alcohol did for me. So that's kind of how I grew up. That's kind of what I brought to alcohol. And, you know, when it does that for you, when it changed me like that, I wanted to feel like that all of the time. I was like, how can I stay altered like this? Because this is how life is meant to be lived. How can I feel like this all of the time? And, you know, when you're 14-ish, 13-ish, I can't remember exactly what, you got to be willing to do some stuff to be able to stay that way 24/7. And I was willing to do it. So I started getting into a lot of trouble. And just me drinking a year, I'd just been drinking a year thereabouts. I was labeled an ungovernable by the state of Florida. I was laughing at, I think it was Dave was talking about the high-speed police chases. I'm like, I've been there, done that, you know? Florida's like you're an ungovernable. In and out of juvenile detention centers, transient youth centers, multiple counselors. I've been saved numerous times. I'm from the South. My family's from the South. You put the hand on the TV and they're going to save you through the TV. I've been confirmed, I mean, twice. My mother was Episcopalian. The first time didn't take, so they sent me back again. You know, I just went in a crazy devil and came out a wet one. You know, it just, nothing changed, but we had hope. But, you know, just all those conversations started about, what are we going to do about Valerie? What's wrong with her? Why can't she get it together? You know, and then the thing that a lot of us are told, you know, we're cursed with potential. You have so much potential. Why can't you just apply yourself? Don't do that. You know about our family history. You just can't be drinking like that. You just can't do it. Just put it down and walk away. I mean, there's complete ignorance within my family, even though my family had been destroyed by alcoholism for generations. Complete ignorance about the disease of alcoholism and its relentless nature. And anyway, so, you know, they were sending me to therapists too, and this one therapist that they sent me to, he told my parents that I had an alcohol and drug problem, and he suggested that I get put into a treatment center on juvenile place. I felt totally betrayed because him and I had smoked weed together. I'm like, how could you? You know, how could you turn me in? But anyway, this was the early 80s, so this is like when insurance was really good, and you could go into treatment for like 3 months and the whole thing was covered. You know, after that experience of going, I was terrified going in. I was angry that I had to go in. I didn't think I had a problem. I thought it was everybody else's problem, but I was happy for the break. I came to love being hospitalized because it's a break and they give you drugs. You know what I mean? So anyway, I was in treatment for 3 months, and I was not a good treatment center participant. I've never been a good rule follower. I have never thought that the rules apply to me. I am someone who will do what you want me to do while you're looking, but the second you turn your back, I'm going to do exactly what I want to do, how I want to do it. And that trait followed me right into sobriety this time too, which, you know, that's a whole lot of self-imposed crisis right there, but we'll talk about that later. So I wasn't a good treatment center participant. You know, if you're good, if you're being good, you get to move up levels and days. If you're participating and not breaking the rules, I was not doing that. I was drinking in treatment. I dropped acid in treatment. I thought it was hysterical. You know, I'm always running over to the boy side or sneaking little boys over. I mean, I was just a lunatic. But it was vacation to me. I mean, it really was. So when I left treatment after being there 90 days, I was on level one, day one, because I could not move forward. I could not follow the rules and comply. So there was not a lot of hope for me. But I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the best thing that could have happened to me, and it probably saved my life. So I just started going to those ANA meetings, and I was in Orange Park, Florida, and there was this AA clubhouse, and I went to the AA clubhouse, and man, I mean, when you're 15 years old and you're looking at people my age now, and like this old guy, you know, I'm sitting in the back and I'm like, my life is over. It is over. Oh my God, I am here with the crusty team. That's what I called them, all these old guys, the crusty team. They're, you know, smoking their cigarettes, drinking their coffee. And this is when you can still smoke a meeting. So there's like, you know, the drips of yellow nicotine coming off the walls and off the window shade. I mean, I was just like, oh my God, my life is over. But I did watch to see where they put the key to their sacred little clubhouse, because I was going to nab that. And I also watched to see what they did with that money that was going around in that little basket. Where was that going? I'm a thief, FYI. Have been for every way that you can possibly be a thief, I have been a thief. Emotionally, mentally, spiritually, your stuff, their stuff, doesn't matter. Equal opportunity, I'll steal it and help you look at it, for it, whatever. Or deny it, you know. Whatever the situation requires. So anyway, I was not a good AA member. I stole a key to their AA clubhouse. That's where I take my friends to go drink. Was at the AA clubhouse. I thought that was hysterical. I really did. I stole their money. And my thinking was, if you're not smart enough to lock it up appropriately, you deserve to have it stolen. I mean, that's really how I thought. That's really how I lived my life. My heroes were like criminals, you know, people that got away with it. Those were the kind of people that I looked up to. So anyway, that's why I love Brian Percott so much, although he got caught, but he's a hell of a guy. But I just love him dearly. Anyway, so I'm treating AA like a revolving door. I don't think I ever put together more than 3 months. I don't even know if I ever made it to 2 months, to be honest with you. I would only run back to Alcoholics Anonymous when I got into trouble. And one night, well, that's a whole nother story. I might not tell that one. Well, all right, I'll tell. So, you know, we're partying the ANA clubhouse, and one of the old timers, Larry, drove by, I guess, saw the cars, and goes up there to check on what's going on, and we're all hightailing it out the back, and I turned around, and he saw me, and I saw him, and, you know, and that was that, and I didn't go back to that clubhouse for a long time. When I was 17, I got into a lot of legal trouble around stealing stuff and to, you know, be able to pay for what I got to do. And the option was you get sober again or we're pressing charges. And of course, I chose sobriety. And at 17, I was at a bottom as much as a 17-year-old can be at a bottom. I was at a bottom. I remember it like it was yesterday. I swore I was never, ever going to drink again. That I was done, I was willing to go to any length, and I didn't know what that meant, but I remember thinking that and feeling that way. I was at a bottom. And I went back to that clubhouse, and this is about the power and the generosity of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those guys knew what I did. They said, "Welcome back, kid, have a seat. We're glad you're back." Now, they did change the locks. The money was in a completely different place. They started doing different stuff with that. Actually, they had started doing that beforehand. You know, and I played innocent. We don't know what's happening to our money. I don't know. But anyway, you know how we like to lie. But I was welcome back. Hey, kid, glad you're back. Have a seat. So I had dropped out of high school. Because, you know, that's just way too much responsibility for me. My life is completely unmanageability in every sense of the word. My dad, my biological father, is now sober out in Los Angeles. And I'm like, that's the ticket. I'm going to move to L.A., man. And it's going to be better. I'm going to be better. I'm going to be with him. He understands me. He's in recovery. You know, I'm going to make this happen. So I call my dad and I say, "Dad, hey, this is your crazy daughter, but hey, I'm sober. I want to come out. I want to live with you." And he goes, "That's fine. You can come out here, but you have to have worked all these steps up to step 9. And then you can come out here." And I'm like, okay. I had no intention of working those steps. So my brilliant plan was to break out the 12 and 12. I'd read a couple chapters, call them up, report in, just seal some stuff that I heard in the meeting and stuff that I read to say that I had taken that step. and basically kind of manipulated my way out there. When I got off the plane, he told me this later, when I got off the plane, he said he knew instantly, that there was nothing different about me, that nothing had changed whatsoever. And isn't it true? I mean, we see it all the time, especially if you're in AA for a while. You see people come in. I mean, we have broken, shattered lives. When we come in here, we're not, you know, exactly, you know, winning in the, you know, emotional, mental. We don't come here on a winning streak. I'll put it that way. We don't come here with things just wonderful in our life. We pretty much burned it to the ground. He just said, I know you haven't done those things. Because when we do those things, something happens. We're transformed. We see people come in all the time. They take these actions that don't make sense. And something happens. They start walking different. They start talking different. They start living different. Their life starts coming together. Relationships get restored. Just there's miracles that happen as a result of the work that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he knew the second he saw me that nothing had happened, that I was still the same liar, cheat, and con. Huh? Are you talking to me? Okay. You're talking to him? Anyway, so I'm out in Los Angeles, and I think I've arrived, and this is what my friend in North Carolina calls sodriety. I was sober, but I was dry, sodriety. This is my sodriety period, okay? So I used to hang out in this clubhouse called the 502 Club in Covina, California, the sobriety capital of the world. And the saying there was, who's on who at the 502? Loved that place. Lots of drama, lots of young people running around. We used to go all over Southern California. We called them the 13-step dances. That was my version of working with others. And this guy, God bless him, he's passed away now, but this guy used to be in the clubhouse. He was just an icon there, a legend there at the 502. His name was Big Book Mac. And Big Book Mac looked at me one time and he goes, "Kid, you need to sit down, shut up, and keep your legs crossed. Because you're missing it. You're missing the whole thing." And I'm like, I went right over my head. I had no idea what he was talking about. I'm like, funny old timer. Let me rub your belly and let's go to the track, you know? I used to love to go with those old guys to the Santa Anita track. Anyway. Because, I mean, who really wants to work or have a job? I mean, or go to school, not me. So I'd hang out and hang with these old guys. And my dad was making financial restitution to me. That's why I didn't have a job. Anyway, that's in a whole nother story. So that's kind of how I ran around Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a sponsor in name only. I did not have a home group. I did not participate in service. I did not work those steps. I went to meetings where you could, like, heckle the speaker. I went to meetings where they were not talking about the solution. A friend of mine said one time, you know, we went to a meeting, and after the meeting, he goes, "Well, that was some good B&B." I go, "B&B, what are you talking about?" He goes, "I don't know, but it wasn't A&A. Yeah? I don't know what they were talking about, but it wasn't AA. So, but those were the kind of meetings I went to. And I know you guys are going to be shocked when I tell you this, but I drank again. I mean, and it happened just like that. There was absolutely no effective mental defense against the first drink whatsoever because I had not done the work. I had not surrendered. I don't think I really believed, when I look back on it with hindsight, I don't think I really believed I or understood what it meant to be an alcoholic. I just didn't get it. So that drink happened, and there was no thought, like, this isn't a good idea. What happened to me is after that first drink was my mind immediately kicked in with the lies, which is, you're too young to be an alcoholic. It was just your family of origin. That's their fault. And you're away from all that now. You're going to be fine. You're older now, wiser now, which was not even close to being true. But, you know, we like to believe our little lies. We are masters at self-deception. So I was like, well, I need to find somebody. I better find a man quick because, you know, somebody's going to have to finance this. And so I did. And God bless him. He had no idea what he was getting into. He had no idea what he was getting into because I am so good. I am such a liar, so dishonest, so manipulative. I will show you exactly what you need me to be so I can get what I need and want from you. And, you know, it's a joke now, but he called me like his diamond in the rough. He had no idea. I was like rock coal still, you know what I mean? There was no, it was going to take a lot of shining for a long time. So to give you an example of what I did to that guy, him and I ended up getting married. And that was a whole exercise as well. But anyway, when I went back to make amends to him in sobriety this time, I went to him and I said, Steve, you know, I was wrong. These are the things I did to harm you. You know, the things that we talk about. And I said, is there anything else you want to tell me? Is there anything else you need to say? He goes, Valerie, you know, that's great. You're sober. Yahoo! He goes, I just want you to know that the 4 years that I was with you were the worst 4 years of my life. I know, not a winning recommendation. But that got my attention. I was talking with someone earlier, with you. Guilty party right there. But we were just talking about, you know, we forget how bad it is what we drag our loved ones through. We're like kind of arrogant to it, kind of, you know, we just don't get it. It takes a while to get it, to really understand. I was telling him we had a guy, a good friend of ours, who's just been struggling with getting sober for like 20 years and brilliant guy, has everything. He's cursed with potential. He has everything in the world to live for. He, you know, has had periods of sobriety in AA, but he can never get past, you know, 3 years. Anyway, he's been on a bender in Texas and came back, and we had to detox him the old school way because he didn't have insurance to be able to go to the hospital to detox. So it's, you know, the 2 ounces of vodka every 4 to 6 hours for 48 hours, you know, and then slowly weaning that down. Anyway, he was sober for 4 days and then he was off again. But just watching the pure chaos of his drinking, his family, his kids, his ex-wife, his mother, I mean, it's just, that's why it's so important that we work with other people. Amen. To be a part of that, to see, to remember, this is what I did. This is how I lived. I lived this ugly life. I did these ugly things. I treated people like this. Anyway, so I get Steve to marry me. We move from Los Angeles to Atlanta. I decide that when I, you know, I love a geographic, but when I get to Atlanta, I decide I'm going to be, this is my, okay, we talked about my sobriety phase, then the find the man to fix it, finance it phase. Now I'm in my raising sheep, tree-hugging, granola-crunching phase. And we bought 20 acres and beautiful spread. And I decided I'm going to be a sheep farmer. I'm going to be like Jesus. Somebody told me, well, Jesus was a carpenter. And I was like, just go with it, you know? I mean, I just had this vision of Jesus with his little, you know, sheepy thing, staff. So, but I really was like, this is it, you know? I mean, it's all the things we try on. It's going to be different over here. I'm going to do this time. I'm going to hang out with these people now. You know, just all the stuff we do, you know, it's kind of like what it talks about in the doctor's opinion. We build it up and tear it down, build it up, tear it down. So, you know, I decided getting married to Steve was going to solve the problem. I thought moving to Atlanta was going to solve the problem. I thought being a sheep herder was going to solve the problem. Pretty soon, I'm drunk with my sheep in the barn. Raising sheep does not work. Thank God I'm not a dude. I'll say that. Because God knows what would happen to those sheep. I know. Did that come out of my mouth? It sure did. I apologize if I offended you. But it's true. Don't shear sheep drunk. You get some bloody sheep. But just, you know, I just keep throwing outside things at my alcoholism thinking that's going to solve the problem. I keep trying to change the people and circumstances and who I am to solve the problem, the internal spiritual malady, the internal unmanageability. And nothing is working. And I'm drinking like a sailor. A drunk sailing sheep herder. And anyway, so my next bright idea is I'm gonna have a kid. I was one of those women who was like, you know what? I'm gonna have a kid. I'm gonna start a family. That's gonna force me to grow up. That's gonna force me to be responsible. That's gonna force me to do the right thing. And live in a good way. And so I, you know, got pregnant, and then we moved up to New York, and I was really, I had my son in Atlanta, and then 2 weeks later we moved up to New York, and my intentions were to be a good mother. My intentions were to be a good wife. But I just could not pull that off. And I was trying really hard after I had my oldest son, Nick, to not drink. And I was getting a little, like, itchy, scratchy, and a little angry. And Steve was out of town, and Nick had a pediatrician appointment. And so I went to the pediatrician, and I was trying to breastfeed, and I was struggling. Because, you know, a dry alcoholic is a little bit of a testy creature, a little anxious, a little wound tight. And, you know, I was trying to explain to the doctor, like, I'm really having a hard time relaxing. I just can't relax. And, you know, I'm like, feel like I'm going to burst, but nothing's happening. And I mean, you know how we just are over the top in explaining ourselves sometimes. And he goes, well, why don't you do this? He goes, why don't you, like, have a beer? And, you know, that'll help calm you down, whole yeast thing going in the beer. I'm like, I don't drink beer. I've always been a liquor drinker. I'm not a beer drinker. I've never understood beer drinkers. I hate the taste of beer. I like liquor, you know? But I became a wino, too, later. I'll just say that. But I'm like, all right, I'll get some beer. I'll take one for the team, you know? And I don't know anything about buying beer. So if you're from upstate New York or you've ever seen this beer, Geneseo Jenny beer, oh my God, I bought the worst beer possible. That stuff is so nasty. But I drank it. And I felt a lot better after that first beer, after I got that first beer down and was able to breastfeed with success. Now, I wish I could tell you that I was the kind of mom that would pump and dump or whatever they call it, where they, you know, drink it and then pump so their baby doesn't get any alcohol. That that just interfered with my drinking. There's no way. My son slept really well, though, I will say that. But there was, when I'm drinking, nothing else, no one else matters. That's the kind of individual I am. I am the kind of mother that will drive drunk into the worst parts of town with their infant son. I'm the kind of mother that will drop their child off and say, I will be back in a couple hours, but I don't come back because I started drinking. And I can't go back yet. I'm not done yet. They'll understand. I'm the kind of mother that wakes up so hungover she can't take care of her child. I am not being a good mom. I'm failing terribly. I'm not being a good wife. I'm failing terribly at being a wife. I don't even understand the concept of commitment. So I started running with bikers too. That was fun. Started carrying a gun, and I just thought I was all that in my little, you know, skull and crossbones do-rag, you know, packing a little. I had to get a Walther PPK because James Bond had it. I needed to be cool. That's what I got. But it was just for show. But, I mean, just that kind of mentality, that kind of running around and just living that kind of life. I mean, I was just leading a very ugly life. Then there was a bunch of series of circumstances that happened, and one night my father, who was called me, which I really tried to avoid his calls at all costs because I didn't want to hear about that AA crap. But anyway, that night, for whatever reason, I answered the phone, and he basically 12-stepped me back into Alcoholics Anonymous. We were getting ready to move to Richmond, Virginia. I said, when I move to Richmond, I'm going to get sober again, and I mean it, you know? It never occurred to me that I could make that decision and then not be able to do it. In my mind, I always quit when I wanted to. I make the decision to stop. Now, I may not stay stopped, but I could stop. It never occurred to me that I would not be able to stop. And our literature describes it perfectly. It doesn't, you know, it talks about no matter how great the need or the wish, human power isn't enough. And that's where my alcoholism progressed to, where I wanted to stop and I just could not. I had great need, had great desire. It wasn't enough to stop me from drinking, from picking up a drink. I went to an AA meeting when I got down there. Now, the name of the meeting was the Phoenix Group. They met on a Monday night, and I thought that was totally apropos because, you know, I'm a drama queen. I was like, I'm going to be like the Phoenix rising from the ashes. And, you know, this is the perfect meeting for me, and I'm such a dork. Anyway, I go to this meeting, and I ask a woman to sponsor me. She said no, but I asked, which is totally not like me. So I asked another woman. She said yes. Now, she ended up being committed 2 weeks later. However, because, you know, we're not always a hotbed of emotional and mental health here. You know that, right? She taught me something really powerful. Really, really powerful. She was, you know, we understood each other. She was cray-cray. But, you know, I was bouncing off the walls, sober. So she was perfect for me. But she took my call every day. And she met me at a meeting every night. And this girl was off the res. I didn't know it. She seemed fine to me. But that, I hear people say sometimes, I just got too much going on. I can't help that person. Or, you know, I'm going through such a hard time myself. I don't know how useful I could really be. And this woman was useful to me, and she was not in good shape. And I always remember her when I feel like saying, oh, I got too much going on. I just don't feel like I have anything to give. And it's not like it's mine to give anyway. It's the power flowing through. It's not mine. I don't rely on my own power to be of service here. That's not what it's about. Amen. Sister. Altar call later. Anyway, y'all might not know what that is, but down south we have some serious altar calls. Anyway, so, you know, I started going to meetings. I felt like I was home. I got that sponsor. I ended up drinking two more times. My last drunk was up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'd gone up there to see an artist. I was representing artists at the time, and I was in his studio. I had no intention of drinking, none whatsoever. He just looks at me and he goes, "Hey, you want a shot of whiskey?" I said, "Yes, I do." Just like that. It happens. I mean, there was nothing there. So I had that one shot down, and he goes, "You want another one?" I'm like, "Yeah, I do." And I took another one, and then Steve showed up, and I was pissed that he showed up. He was pissed that I was drinking. I was mad because I'd only gotten two down before he showed up. And that is the alcoholic torture that they're talking about, the emotional, mental, physical torture that we can go through once we set that allergy off. It's like where your mind, my mind kicked into high gear. How do I get away from you? How do I create a distraction so I can go drink? I got to finish this. I will never forget the feeling of just feeling like I was being torn in two, just needing another drink so badly, and my mind just would not stop. So we happened to be staying at his sister's house, and she had some beer up in the fridge. And so I snuck upstairs once everybody had gone to sleep after being just a jerk all day long and causing all kinds of problems in the family. And it was a really bad day. And anyway, I'm upstairs once they've all gone to sleep and I'm drinking beer. And as I'm drinking, I said, "God, help me. Just God, help me. I can't keep doing this and I can't stop. God, help me." And I got, you know, Shazammed or something. Because, and I don't know if that was my complete and total internal surrender that people have been trying to give me for years. But it has to come from within. And that was mine. And I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink since then. And I'm so very grateful for that experience. Sobriety has been interesting. I got very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was still very, very sick emotionally, mentally. I've really grown up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what it meant to be self-supporting in any kind of way. I didn't know how to have honest relationships with people. I didn't know how to just not be a taker. But you guys loved me and kept encouraging me, and I kept going to meetings and got another sponsor and started taking steps. And, you know, I started to get better. Things were getting better. I wasn't creating the chaos that I was creating previously. Steve and I ended up divorced at around 3.5 years sober. I hit my first sober, notice I said first. If you're here and you're like in your first 10, there's more, get ready. I used to be like, "Oh yeah, that'll never happen to me. I'm gonna be so spiritually fit, you can bounce quarters off my spiritual program." That's, yeah, whatever. Anyway, so I hit my first spiritual bottom. In a sober bottom at around 3.5 years, and I'm like, AA doesn't work. You know, my life is a train wreck. I hate the people in AA. They're all a bunch of hypocrites, which, yes, we are, you know? you know, I was page 52, the bedevilments. I was just walking untreated alcoholism. I was vacillating between homicidal rage and suicidal depression. Those were like my only two channels. And I knew that I was going to drink again or take my own life. I knew it. I was thinking about suicide every day. And I knew that that was what was going to happen. And then through a weird series of events, I met this woman named Camille. And I ended up hosting her at a conference. And I'm sitting there telling her my tale of woe and about, you know, how my life is crap. It's always been crap and it's always going to be crap and this stuff doesn't work. And, you know, I'm just a hopeless, you know how we go on. And she looks at me and she goes, she sounded like a bad Louisiana psychic. She goes, "You're going to die. You're going to die unless you get into all three parts of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to die. You're a mad dog alcoholic, and you're going to die." And I knew what she was saying to me was true. I knew it. I loved her, too, because she talked about being 12 years sober. She was in Colorado, crazy as a lunatic. She was dating some guy who was unrecovered, a gambler, and she was dry 12 years. She was sitting in her house with the shotgun waiting for him to walk through the door because she was going to blow the old boy away. I'm like, "I love you. Yes. You must help me." That's what they're saying. Like, our darkest things, the things that we can be the most ashamed of, the most embarrassed of, the stuff that is like really not pretty, you know, will be put to good use. And that story, her saying that and her, you know, "you're going to die" thing, she scared me to death. And that was something because I when I sobered up, I had a small anger problem. I haven't had the cops called on me in a long time in sobriety, but I have had them called on me in sobriety, which maybe I'll tell you some of those stories, but it's been a long time, I'm changed. But that's why I connected with her. I understood that kind of anger. And she got me, and she was not that woman anymore. And I wanted what she had. I said, "Tell me what to do. I am willing to do it." And she started sponsoring me. And she said, "You know, let's talk about those three legacies. What are you doing in Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, what have you done in the steps?" "Well, you know, with the steps, I've done bits and pieces, you know. There are things that I left off my inventory that I will never, ever, ever tell another human being. And there are amends that I will never, ever make. They owe me, as a matter of fact. And, you know, I help people when it's convenient." And that was all true. And she goes, "Well, how are you conducting? You got a home group?" I'm like, "Eh." "You got commitments in your home group?" "Eh, yeah." "Do you show up for those commitments?" "You know, if it's convenient." And she goes, "Well, I don't know. I guess you're not being of service, are you?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, sometimes I'll pick up this gal down the road and take her to a meeting. But sometimes she calls me and asks me to go to the meeting, pick her up for the meeting. I tell her I will, but then I don't show up." I know. I was such a jerk. Because I'm totally wrapped up in self. I haven't woken up spiritually to nothing. So anyway, she goes, "Well, you're in bad shape. No wonder you want to die. That kind of self-centeredness is painful." And yes, it is. Yes, it is. And she goes, "Well, if you are willing to do some things, I am willing to help you. You know, we're going to start at the beginning of this book. When it says write, we're going to write. When it says pray, we're going to pray. When it asks a question, we're going to answer it. When it gives us a direction to go do something, we're going to go do it. You're going to get a home group, and it has to be a home group that is active in the AA structure. It participates. They meet regularly. They give their money regularly. they have service commitments, and you have to be at that group unless you are dead, sick, or out of town. And once you get through these steps, I expect you, it is your job to carry this message to the still suffering alcoholic. And if you are willing to do those things, I will help you. And she could have cared less what my answer was. She was as willing and able. And she scared me, and I saw hope, and I said yes. And it changed everything in my life and changed my sobriety completely, completely. I was 3.5 years sober before I really understood what it meant to be an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I'd never read the doctor's opinion. I mean, that looks boring, you know? I mean, I read how it works, you know, that's it. I had no idea there were directions in the big book. Not a clue. So anyway, she just saved my life. But she took me through and she said, you know, you got to bring your experience to these words, to what they're talking about here. They spend a lot of time on the first step to help you find your truth here. Are you an alcoholic of the hopeless variety? Did you try everything and nothing else worked? Could you control it once you started? Every single time. You know, so just things like that. She started, and the big book started validating my experience. Yes, that's me. I felt like that. I thought like that. I drank like that. I lived like that. That was me. And that's when that internal concession happened for me. And I was 3.5 years sober when that first step concession happened. And I think it's so necessary. There's no way I'd go do the rest of the steps or do what we do in AA if that first step wasn't firmly in place. There's no way. Why would I? I don't have to. So anyway, we got busy going on through the rest of the steps, and I'll do the highlight reel here for you. The second step, I had some real problems with this higher power God business. I had a lot of old ideas about God. I thought that God had favorites. I thought that the spiritual life was all about suffering. I thought you had to do this stuff perfectly or you would get no relief. I thought there were the haves and the have-nots. I would always be a have-not. That God withholds. I mean, I just had a lot of really negative ideas about God. And I remember calling my sponsor one time with that stuff. And my sponsor said, well, you have God set up as a version of you. And I'm like, well, if you're going to put it that way. So, you know, but that's the key to strong sponsorship is and they talk about it all throughout We Agnostics. You know, we got to set aside what we think we know. Can you set aside what you believe may be true about this power so you can find a relationship with this power? Is it possible? Greatest question that we ask. Is it possible that you're wrong? Is it possible that there's something else for you? When we got to the third step, I was like terrified, like, oh my God, you know, I've had to set aside all this new stuff. Now this God's going to want me to go be a nun in South America and never have like sex or money again ever in my life. And I can't do it. And this is like when great sponsorship chimes in and my sponsor said, well, you know, if that happens to you, it's a lot better than what you currently got going on. So nothing to lose here. And I'm like, well, that is true. If that had happened, then that would have been a lot better than what was currently going on in my life. So I got down on my knees and I did that prayer. And like has been shared, you know, how do you know you've done a third step? You start writing your fourth step. It's not complicated at all. And I started making that list and some things that have really helped me over the years and in writing inventory. I have no idea where I am on time. I have 5 minutes? No. I'm going to pull a Dave. I got 10. I'm talking my whole time, baby. Well, what can I share with you? I'm not going to go through all the steps. I will say this. The steps are our design for living. And they're just as pertinent to me today, almost 29 years sober, almost 30 years sober. They're still an active part of how I live. I'm an active member of my home group. You know, I sponsor women. We've got a big book study rolling at my house on Thursday nights, where there's a whole group of women. We're going through the steps together again as a group, and we're going to follow those directions together as a group. So let me just tell you a little bit about what stuff, that's kind of what's currently going on in my life. But I'll share this with you. When I hit 20 years of sobriety, the wheels came off in my life. And I got leveled in, I mean, I was on the verge of being queen to Miss AA, FYI. Just so you know. I turned 20, and I felt like one of those AA cliches, you know, like, oh, yeah. I would hear people say, oh, yeah, I turned 20, and then, you know, if life came to visit, and I was like, that'll never happen to me, you know, because my kung fu is strong, you know. And, I mean, yes, it did, and more. And I just got leveled in every area of my life. You know, in sobriety, my life had been put back together in the most remarkable ways. My first husband that I told you about that passed away, or that said that's the worst 4 years of my life, I became the best ex-wife-in-law ever. And especially to his next two wives, I was like the best. And I mean, I just loved him. And we had a son. He got cancer. And, you know, it was a long, drawn-out thing. So when he was in the hospital dying, as a result of what you guys showed me on how we live, what we do, the transformation that happens here as a result of trying to live this way, very imperfectly, but we got to try, do our best. I was in the hospital with that man, holding his hand, kissing his cheek as he was leaving this world. And that is a gift. That was one of the most powerful experiences. I'll still talk to him every once in a while, but when we got to have a discussion about my oldest, I have a 32-year-old and I have a 12-year-old. I called my mother. I had no intention of getting pregnant, FYI, at 43, but 42. I called my mom. I'm like, I don't know how this happened. She goes, let me explain something to you. I'm like, that's not what I meant. But, you know. My mom is a character. Just so many amazing, my family's been put together. I mean, and a lot of that happened through sponsorship and being willing to carry the message. You know, in sharing in that language of the heart, a lot of healing happened for me and my past experiences. So 20 years sober, I'm pregnant, oh my God. My life is, well, I just, whatever. Had this kid, turned 20, lost my job, lost another job, had a miscarriage, don't ask. I'm too old for that stuff. And went through a divorce. That was horrible. I mean, an AA divorce is the worst. Can be. Him and I are very close today. But it was very, very painful. Went through a whole judgment with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can tell you from my own experience that old timers go through difficulties too. And I have seen old-timers who, when life came to visit, and they're face-to-face with their own flaws and their own weaknesses, and it became available for public consumption, and they had to live up to the ideal or the pedestal that we can put them on, and they end up drinking again or taking their own life. And I've seen it over and over. So I guess the only reason I share that with you is if you see somebody in AA that you think has arrived in some way, do something really stupid, they're just a drunk. They are just a drunk. And they need support and love just like everybody else, just like the newcomer who's walking in. We're all in this together, no matter where we're at on our journey. Anyway, so then I got diagnosed with cancer. And I'm like, can it get any better? I'm like, God, you suck. And I don't want anything to do with you anymore. And I just really closed the door to Alcoholics Anonymous and to God and to the people in AA. And the only way I know how to describe that is like I shut the door and I put my foot on it, so to speak. And then, this is the great thing, because, you know, this is when God uses your ego. I had this little guy call me up, Nathan. He called me up and he goes, hey, I haven't seen you around, but somebody told me that I should call you, that you would be the only person that could help me. Can I come see? Will you take me through the steps? You know, even though I hated everybody, I was like, all right, fine. You know. So, but that kid saved my life, kept me in the solution, kept me participating, even though I was just so, I'd just gotten so sick in every way you can get sick in AA. You know, I was sick physically with the cancer. I was just, and emotionally and mentally and spiritually, just shut down. I just experienced so much grief and loss, and my father had died. It just felt like it just kept coming. I just couldn't catch my breath. But I stayed sober through all of that. And I kept doing what AA asked us to do. And because I have woken up here, I could not say no. As a matter of fact, if you do this work, we were talking about this too, if you do this work, you're going to wake up spiritually. You're compelled to go help other people. You can't not do it. You just can't. You have to. Something just is going to make way. So good news. Life is great. My life's been put back together again. I've been put back together. God and I are on good terms. I just got married. So I've been married we just celebrated our year anniversary. Thank you. You know, I'm hoping for that three times a charm. But I'm like, you know, I'm kind of crazy. So let's hope it sticks, you know. But I'm very honored to be here. We're all so blessed to be here tonight together, sober. I mean, we should be locked up. We should be dead. Seriously, we should. We should be causing untold damage or, you know, drinking at home alone, rolling around in our own vomit and pee-pee. That's what we do. You know, the fun only lasts for so long, right? But we're all here together. We're all here sharing. My sponsor, Don, used to say the most powerful thing that happens at these things is not when the speakers are speaking or the workshop. It's what happens before and after, the connection that's happening, one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, sharing that experience, strength, and hope. And we got that in loads this weekend. So thank you so much. Pleasure, privilege to be here.